pinks and whites. I went to pick a flower, then drew my hand back at the last moment. I recognized them for what they were. Oleander. And I heard Princess Beatrice's voice saying to her children, "Those pink ones are oleander and very poisonous." Chapter 33. I stood there like a statue, staring down at the flowers as they stirred in the breeze, so pretty and yet so deadly. And the leaves of the oleander, smooth and slim, not unlike those of the bay tree. I had put bay leaves into my fish stew. I remembered the Count complaining that bay leaves had been left in his bouillabaisse when I was sure that I had removed them all. Actually, now that I came to think of it, I would swear that there were no stray bay leaves in the soup. I had cooked the herbs in the usual muslin bag, so they were easy to remove. What if someone had sprinkled oleander leaves onto the portion of food I had sent up to the Count's room? I had to find Dr. Reed immediately. I crossed the lawn as speedily as Princess Sophie had done. Princess Sophie, who had been so sweet and gentle before and now demanded punishment for everyone connected to the Count's death. She had been there at the picnic. She had heard when Princess Beatrice had warned her children about the oleander. Chilling thoughts were racing through my brain. Princess Sophie had claimed a headache and not attended the parade. So how did she know that the benches were hard and the royal stand was right at the front with the crowd pressing in on all sides? Perhaps one of the ladies had described the scene for her, or perhaps she had seen it herself from across the street as she waited to fire the revolver and kill her betrothed. What better time and place when everyone was in disguise, wearing masks, jollier from too much wine? She could have fired the gun, watched the Count fall, whipped off a mask and suddenly been a frightened girl asking what had happened. Which was why the gun had ended up in the bushes here at the hotel. She had to get back before the royal party, so she did not have time to hide the gun anywhere else. All of this was pure supposition, of course. But oleander leaves, well, at least they could be proven to be the source of the Count's demise. I went in search of Dr. Reed and found him coming down the stairs from visiting the four cooks. "How are my colleagues today?" I asked. "Finally we see the light at the end of the tunnel," he said. "The young lad is almost ready to be up and about. The older men are still weak, but at least they are keeping down nourishment now, which is a good sign. I rather feared for their lives at one stage, I can tell you."
"That is good news," I said.
"Was there something you wanted, Miss Barton?"
"Yes, I wanted to ask you what you know about oleander poisoning."
He looked puzzled. "Oleander? Not much. I know it's supposed to be toxic.
But would you know what the symptoms would be?"
"I can't say I would." "Why the interest?"
"Because I believe the Count was not killed by a poisonous mushroom at all, but by oleander leaves, put into the bouillabaisse I sent up to his room when he was recovering from the gunshot wound. I need to know whether the poison would take more than one day to kill a person. You see, the Count came into the kitchen, as he sometimes did, to complain about the food that had been sent up to his room. One of his complaints was that I had not removed the bay leaves from his bouillabaisse. Well, Doctor, I remember clearly that the bay leaves were in a muslin bag, and I know I removed it. And in the garden just now, I noticed how oleander leaves can resemble bay, especially if they are broken up." He gave me an incredulous stare.
"And who could possibly do such a thing?"
"I have my suspicions, but I won't say more until you can examine the body and find out if I am correct."
"Very well," he said. "I am sure that the inspector from Scotland Yard would say you were clutching at straws to try and clear your own name. But I think you seem to be a trustworthy and sensible young woman, and I can see no reason why you would want to harm any member of the royal family. So I'll do what you say. I shall need to visit a French colleague, as I'm sure my own medical textbooks do not deal with oleanders. I think it's too cold in England for them to grow." So off he went, and all I could do was wait. I was not cooking. I stayed clear of the kitchen just in case any further suspicions fell upon me. And I found myself wondering about Jean-Paul.
he was the one who had selected the mushrooms. He could also have had every opportunity to put oleander leaves into my bouillabaisse, and he had been at the carnival where, he confessed, he had been drinking. I knew nothing about him, other than that he was a talented chef and his kiss had been incredible. But what if he was an anti-royalist? What if he had taken the job at the hotel with the intention of doing away with the royal family? I shook my head. I didn't want to believe that. I also didn't want to believe that I was so attracted to him, that he was the first man who had ever made me feel alive. I took my meals in the staff dining room with the other employees, but they avoided contact with me, as if they didn't want my current disgrace to rub off on them. Jean-Paul tried to offer a kind word. He saw that I was toying with a bowl of consommé and brought a plate over to me. "Here," he said, "try some of these noodles. I made them myself. You need to eat and keep up your strength." The thoughtfulness brought tears to my eyes. "I can't seem to swallow anything," I said. "It's just like waiting for the stroke of doom to fall." He put a hand on my shoulder. "You'll come through this. You are strong and you have done nothing wrong. The truth will come out, I assure you. Myself, I do not believe that it had anything to do with a mushroom. I would swear by all the saints that the stallkeeper is an honourable man who knows his trade. I am sure they will find that the Count died of another complaint. Maybe he caught the same disease that has felled your colleagues." "Maybe," I said. I couldn't tell him that every minute we had to wait meant it was all the more likely that information would come back from England stating that Helen Barton was dead and that I was an impostor. Then nobody would believe me. The situation felt hopeless, until I reminded myself that I did have allies. Lady Mary was on my side. Giles Waverley, too, I hoped. But what could they do if a policeman from Scotland Yard got into his head that I was guilty of murder? A whole long day went by, in which I received no form of communication. The doctor did not report back on the effects of oleander, and Lady Mary had not yet managed to arrange a tea party for the Waverleys. The hours dragged on, the weather changed, a storm came in, bringing blustery rain and making escape to the gardens impossible. I sat alone in my room and wondered if I should write to my sister, telling her the whole truth of what had happened to me. Would she care? And even if she cared, what could she do about my current predicament? A butcher's family is not likely to have influence in royal circles, and Louisa might even be on her way to Australia by now. Then an idea came to me. Had the Count's room been cleaned since he was found dead? Was it left intact for the police to go over? If so, might he have removed a fragment of oleander leaf from his mouth and thrown it to the floor in disgust? I decided to risk taking a look for myself. I went up to visit Jimmy, who was now sitting up in bed looking pale, but with eyes that lit up as he saw me. The window was wide open, but even so, the cloying odour of sickness lingered, and I swallowed back my revulsion. "Well, if it takes nearly dying of stomach poisoning to make a pretty girl visit my room, I'm all for it," he said. "I'm so glad you are feeling better," I said. "The doctor was really worried about all of you." "Me too. I thought I'd had my chips," he said. "Never felt worse in my life. I think that's put me off ice cream forever." "Maybe stick to reputable ice cream parlours in future," I said. "I shall be so glad when you can all come back to work." "I know. I felt so badly for you, you must have been run off your feet." "It hasn't been too terrible. Chef Le Pan had his men take over the bulk of the cooking and I just prepared the meals for the royal party, with dire consequences, as I'm sure you must have heard." "No, we've heard nothing shut away up here. The doctor was so worried it might be catching. He had one hotel footman bring our meals, and that was a bloke who had survived typhoid." "Well," I took a deep breath, "your favourite count has died, and I've been accused of poisoning him." He gave me an incredulous look, then burst out laughing. "Lucky I was shut away up here, or I'd have been a suspect myself." "It's not funny, Jimmy. There is a policeman out from London who is determined to find that I poisoned the count deliberately." "How are you supposed to have done it?" "With a bad mushroom, they think, but I'm not so sure, so I thought I'd take a look at the Count's room." I thought you'd know which room it is.
Oh, so you only came up to see me because you wanted the Count's room number, eh?
We were not allowed anywhere near you until today, I said. I've been asking about you all the time.
Fair enough, he said. But a fellow can hope, can't he? And you're right. The Count did give me his room number. He wanted me to bring up a nightcap. Of course, I didn't obey that one. I wasn't born yesterday.
He was quite persistent, wasn't he?
He nodded. A pain in the you-know-what. I can't say I'm sorry he's kicked the bucket. So anything I can do to help you clear your name, just let me know. It's room 24, two floors above the Queen's.
I thanked him and hurried back down the stairs. It was mid-morning. I suspected the royal party would be in one of the sitting rooms. They would not have gone out in such weather. I walked slowly along the corridor leading to the Count's room, listening for any sign that a room might be occupied. I'd better have a good excuse, I thought. I was sent to find Sir Arthur, as the London policeman wanted him. Yes, that would do. I came to number 24, tapped on the door, waited, and then turned the doorknob. The door was not locked, which I thought was lax on their behalf. It swung open, and I stepped into a darkened room. The heavy velvet curtains had been drawn across high windows, and the room smelled, as Jimmy's had done, of sickness. The Count had vomited in here. I tiptoed across the room and pulled back one of the curtains. Suddenly, it occurred to me that the Count might still be lying in his bed. I spun around, heart racing, then gave a sigh of relief when I saw that the bed was empty and had been made up. But that also made me think that the room had been cleaned. Of course, if the Count had vomited over his sheets, they would have been changed right away. I went around the bed, but could find no trace of a fragment of leaf. Disappointed, I was about to leave when my gaze fell upon an elaborate box of chocolates on the bedside table. I opened the lid. One chocolate had been taken, the rest of the box was untouched. This struck me as strange. The Count had shown himself to be a greedy person. If someone had given him a box of chocolates, would he not have eaten several at once? I picked it up and took it with me. One never knew when it might be useful. Not to eat, but as evidence. I took it up to my room without being seen.
Chapter 34. I was just coming down the stairs again when I encountered Dr. Reed.
Miss Barton, he said, we were looking for you. Please come to Sir Arthur's sitting room. We need to talk.
I followed him and found Sir Arthur and the London policeman already sitting there. The room was heavy with pipe smoke and my eyes stung. This in itself was unusual. The Queen did not approve of smoking, and even her relatives went outside to smoke at the palace. Sir Arthur, a man of perfect manners, rose to his feet as I entered. The police inspector did not.
Good of you to come, Miss Barton, Sir Arthur said. Please do take a seat.
I sat. I detected that the tone had changed. Their manner to me had shifted slightly.
Miss Barton, Inspector Raleigh said, what made you suspect that the Count might have died from eating poisonous oleander leaves?
He came into the kitchen to complain about several things, including not being served any red meat for his luncheon, I said. One of the things he complained about was that I had left bits of bay leaf in the bouillabaisse.
The what? He asked sharply.
It's a local fish stew, I said, very tasty.
And did you cook it with bay leaves?
Yes, but in the customary muslin bag. I removed it before I served the dish.
So you immediately jumped to the conclusion that these were not bay leaves, but oleander?
No, sir. I only began to see the connection when I encountered Princess Sophie in the gardens. She had been talking to me in a most hostile manner, saying that she wanted the storekeeper, the chef, and myself all prosecuted for killing her betrothed. Then suddenly she looked past me, and her expression changed. I saw fear in her eyes, and she ran off. I couldn't think what she might have seen that produced this reaction. There was nobody in sight, and we were on a lawn edged with oleander bushes. That's when I remembered we had been on a picnic, and Princess Beatrice had made a point of stressing to her children how poisonous oleanders were. I paused, waiting for a reaction.
Princess Sophie, which one is she?
The inspector asked.
She is a German princess, a young cousin of the Queen, Sir Arthur said. She was engaged to marry the Count.
So what is this young woman trying to suggest here? That a princess killed her intended? The inspector looked at Dr. Reed for confirmation.
Yes, sir, that is what I am suggesting.
And what would make her do that?
I came across her on the day of the picnic. She was crying. I tried to comfort her, and she told me that she did not want to marry the Count. She called him a monster. I tried to intervene with the Queen, but the Queen was adamant that the wedding was politically important and would take place.
The inspector had put down his pipe and was now leaning forward, glaring at me.
You're a cook, correct?
Yes, sir.
And yet you console princesses and chat with the Queen.
That seems rather improbable to me.
I suggest you ask Her Majesty for confirmation if you don't believe me, I said.
But why? Why would people of their rank want to confide in the likes of you?
One can see that Miss Barton is a young lady of good breeding, Sir Arthur said.
Coming from a cottage on a Yorkshire moor? Going into service at the age of 12?
How does that equate with good breeding? The policeman asked.
Oh, goodness, I thought. They had already checked into my supposed background that was on file at the palace. There was nothing for it but to bluff it out for now.
My father was an educated man, I said. Unfortunately, I was orphaned at a young age and had no choice but to go into service.
I decided to change the subject.
But what I want to know, Dr. Reed, is whether the Count did die from oleander poisoning.
It seems highly possible, he said. It causes confusion, dizziness, nausea, and finally the heart to fail, which was how the Count died.
So he was already suffering when he came into my kitchen, I said. He stumbled, he couldn't focus properly, and his speech was a little slurred. I wondered if he had been drinking.
You prepared this fish stew, the inspector said. And then what? Was there an occasion on which someone could have added these leaves to it?
Not while it was in the kitchen. I was feeling more hopeful now, and my voice showed it.
A footman came in. I served a portion and put it on a tray. The footman carried it up to the Count.
This footman has been questioned, Sir Arthur said. He says he was about to take it in to the Count when Princess Sophie arrived. She told him she wanted a few minutes with her intended and he should leave it on the table outside the room.
So she had plenty of opportunity to put the oleander into the dish and give it time to infiltrate the broth, I said. They nodded.
If it indeed turns out to be the princess, Sir Arthur said slowly,
and at this point all suspicion does seem to be pointing towards her,
I have no idea how we could ever prove it or what protocol would be.
Should Her Majesty be told? Should the distressing news be kept from her?
And what of Princess Sophie? The inspector asked. Are you planning to let her walk away scot-free?
It needs careful consideration, Sir Arthur said. We have to consider the ramifications of an international incident. Her father is a powerful man in his own right. He has allies across Europe, the Holy Roman Emperor, the Kaiser.
As you say, Dr. Reed agreed, we can never prove it. I don't think we'd get the young lady to confess.
One more thing you should know, I said. I think she tried to kill him previously.
Really? When was that?
The inspector was now sitting up straight, leaning towards me.
I believe she was the one who fired the shot, not at the Queen, but at Count Wilhelm. Not being a very good shot, she only struck his shoulder.
How on earth did you come up with that idea? The inspector asked.
The princess did not attend the parade. She claimed she had a headache and stayed behind. And remember, Sir Arthur, I found the gun in the bushes and gave it to you. If it had been an anarchist, an outsider, he would have had plenty of chances to dispose of the gun somewhere far away, throw it into the sea. I believe she had to get back here in a hurry, giving her no chance to get rid of the gun.
Goodness me,
Sir Arthur looked quite disturbed now. Not so the inspector.
You know what I find interesting, he said slowly,
is this young woman's role in the business?
She cooks the pie, but claims she knows nothing about mushrooms. She discovers the oleander connection, but claims she didn't put the leaves in there herself. And now she tells us that she found the gun and deduces that Princess Sophie fired it because it was in the bushes beside the hotel.
all a little too pat, don't you think?
What exactly are you hinting at, Chief Inspector? Sir Arthur asked. That for some reason, she is very keen to implicate Princess Sophie.
And her motive would be?
To save herself, of course. He looked rather pleased with himself. I had had enough now.
Chief Inspector, I said, I don't know why you have this idea in your head that I am somehow against the royal family. It was the greatest honour of my life to come and work for the Queen, and if I really had committed these crimes, would I have told you about the Oleander? Would I have brought the gun I had hidden to Sir Arthur?
She's got a point there, Dr. Reed said. I could tell he was on my side.
Maybe, the inspector said. Maybe not. It's just that something's not quite right. I've dealt with enough investigations and enough criminals during my long career that I've developed a nose. I know when something is not what it should be, and there is something about you, Miss Barton, that troubles me. I aim to find out what it is.
I think you are being unnecessarily harsh, Chief Inspector, Sir Arthur said. This young lady could not have been more helpful, nor more intuitive. Although I'm afraid you were brought out from London for nothing, and we shall have to let the matter rest. At least it seems to me that we have hit upon the truth, thanks to Miss Barton's keen observations.
If you say so, Sir Arthur. The policeman looked to him defiantly. He knew he was outranked. An ordinary policeman has to defer to a knight of the realm. His gaze moved on to me. I'm going to find out the truth, don't you worry, it said.
Once outside, it took me a moment to compose myself. The inspector was going to find out the truth about me. That would actually not be too hard. But what happened after that? If he sought out Ronnie Barton, might Ronnie not enjoy telling him that I had pushed his sister under the omnibus in order to gain her position? I could tell the policeman was anxious to find me guilty of something. A murder would be very satisfying for him. I knew I had to somehow prove my innocence in the matter of Count Wilhelm, even though it seemed that Sir Arthur and Dr. Reed were perfectly willing to accept my theory about Princess Sophie. If only I could make her confess. I thought about the box of chocolates with one missing, and Princess Helena screaming that something had been taken from her. I frowned. I had thought it might be a gun that had been taken, but it was more likely something to do with her addiction to drugs. I held my breath. Was it possible? I lingered in the hallway until Sir Arthur and Dr. Reed finally emerged from the room. Then I followed Dr. Reed until he turned towards his own suite, then ran up behind him.
Excuse me, Doctor, may I have a word in private? I asked.
He stopped and looked back at me.
Why, of course, Miss Barton. This whole affair must have been most distressing for you.
I nodded.
Most distressing, Doctor. But I think I might have found a way to finally get at the truth, beyond a doubt.
He was frowning.
Go on.
Were there any drugs found in the Count's system?
He was looking suspicious now.
There were.
Opioids. Probably that new drug heroin, supposedly much cleaner and safer than the original opium. The German company Bayer has put it on the market this year as being beneficial to coughs.
So the Count had some of this in his system.
He did. That did not surprise me, nor raise alarms. I have found that the aristocratic classes are all too fond of such substances, sometimes to the point of addiction.
Princess Helena, I said. I know about her.
How on earth did you know that?
She asked me to go into the town for her and buy a list of things at the chemist. I recognized the names on the paper she gave me.
Well, I never.
He shook his head.
And you think the Count was also addicted to drugs?
No, I said. I think they might have been given to him. Tell me, Doctor, if someone had administered heroin to him at the same time he was being fed oleander and right after he had lost blood from a gunshot wound, would the combination of all three have speeded up his demise?
Most definitely, Dr. Reed said,
certainly contributed to the slowing of the heart and breathing.
But what are you suggesting now?
If you're agreeable, I think we might be able to prove something.
I drew close to him and whispered. He looked surprised, then nodded.
Very well.
We've nothing to lose in this case. I'm willing to give it a try.
Chapter 35. Princess Sophie looked composed and calm when she entered the small sitting room.
You wanted me, Doctor? She asked. You say there have been further developments in the death of my beloved Wilhelm?
Please do take a seat, Princess, the doctor said. All will be made clear, I promise you.
As she sat on an upright chair, upholstered in royal blue silk, she looked across and noticed me, standing off to one side behind the sofa.
What is she doing here?
Ah, I understand. You have brought her to make a confession.
Excellent. So she did not know the mushroom was poisonous.
She gave a nod of satisfaction.
Yes, I think we can prove that the death was intentional, the doctor said. Shall I ring for some tea, a little refreshment?
No, thank you. Let us proceed. I wish to hear this girl's confession and see her handed over to the French police.
She was sitting very upright, her pale skin above the black gown making her look like a ghost. Her blue eyes seemed unnaturally wide.
Or perhaps you would like a chocolate, the doctor said. He took the box from a side table and placed it in front of her.
I must say they look very enticing.
She had gone, if anything, paler. I heard a little gasp.
Where did you find these?
They were in the Count's room, the doctor said, and since he will not be enjoying them any longer, I thought it was a shame to let them go to waste. My Scottish upbringing, you know, has taught me frugality.
Do have one.
He took the lid off the box and offered it to her.
No, thank you. I am too distressed to eat, and especially could not touch something that had belonged to my dear Wilhelm.
Then I hope you won't mind if I do, the doctor said in his most jolly manner. I must confess to a horribly sweet tooth. He reached into the box, took out a large chocolate near the centre, and brought it up to his mouth. I watched, fascinated. As he was about to bite, Princess Sophie cried out,
No, don't!
The doctor looked up, holding the chocolate a few inches from his mouth.
Why not?
Because, she began.
Because the chocolate has been injected with heroin, I asked.
Her look now was pure venom.
How did you know this? You are a servant. What right do you have to poke your nose into the affairs of your betters?
So, Your Highness, the doctor said, you do admit that there might be heroin in this chocolate. You stole your cousin Helena's syringe and her bottle of heroin, and you injected the chocolates.
Only some of them. The big ones in the centre. He was greedy. He always wanted the biggest, the best. I knew he would take them first.
You wanted to make sure that the oleander did its job, I said, just in case he did not eat enough of it.
I had no idea how much oleander it would take to kill somebody, she said.
You were clearly desperate when the gunshot missed its target, Dr. Reed said in his calm, even voice. Her eyes registered surprise and alarm that this, too, had been found out. There was defiance as she stared at us.
What does it matter? There is nothing that you can do. My cousin Victoria will not take a servant's word over mine. She will believe me that the girl killed Wilhelm and tried to plant the blame on me.
You'll see.
You will suffer for this, she said the last words to me with great venom.
But she will take my word, Princess, Dr. Reed said. She trusts me absolutely, and I believe what Miss Barton has said is correct and true. Besides, we both saw you preventing me from eating the chocolate.
Stupid trickery!
Sophie spat out the words, then she shrugged and actually smiled.
In any case, what do I care? My cousin will not let any scandal get out. She will not risk the reputation of the royal family. She will find me another husband. I will marry and live happily ever after.
Who will want to marry you when you have already poisoned one man who displeased you? I thought. It was not my place to say anything. She swept out of the room, her head held high.
Well done, Dr. Reed said.
You have a good head on your shoulders, Miss Barton.
I wonder what will become of her, I said.
Will you tell the Queen?
I rather fear that the Queen must be told, he said. Fortunately, that task will fall to Sir Arthur, not to me. But I also think that Princess Sophie is right. Nothing will be done. The reputation and honour of the royal family must remain intact. I actually pity the girl, to be so desperate not to marry that she resorts to the most violent means. You and I cannot understand what it must be like to be a pawn in an international game of chess.
No, you're right, I said. He gave me a long, hard look.
At least this means you are off the hook now, completely exonerated of any misdoing.
I rather fear that inspector from London does not think so, I said. I have the feeling he wants to poke and pry into my past until he finds something.
Is he likely to find something? Dr. Reed asked.
I hesitated. He was a kind man, I was sure. I could tell him, but I couldn't. I've not done anything criminal or illegal in my life, I said.
That's what I thought. We'll make sure he is sent back to London, don't worry.
He chuckled, as if this was amusing. It wasn't to me. I went back to my room and waited. Still no word from Lady Mary. Perhaps the Waverleys did not like tea, or were not interested in a tea party with her, or were otherwise occupied, or were travelling. At the very least, she had promised I could stay with her, and she would introduce me as a young cousin. I did have an escape, if I wanted to escape, that was. In truth, I was happy in my current position, and I didn't want to leave it. I was just learning new skills, but I had to ask myself whether I wanted to be a cook all my life. Like Jean-Paul, I could never marry and carry on my profession. No man would ever allow his wife to work outside the home, especially not to all hours in someone else's kitchen. Would I want to be like Mrs. Sims one day, called Mrs. as a token of respect, but having never had a husband or a home of her own? The truth was that I didn't know. I was young. I had so much to experience, so much to learn yet. All I could do was pray that Chief Inspector Raleigh let the whole investigation drop now that the culprit had been found and had confessed. Perhaps he had more important fish to fry in London. One could only hope. Another day passed with no news, except that my stricken colleagues came back to the kitchen, looking pale and weak, mere shadows of their former selves. Even Mr. Phelps, usually brusque and picky, was extremely polite and grateful to me for every little thing. I was complimented on holding the fort so bravely. I decided to keep the matter of the mushrooms from them. There was no point in their knowing what I had been through. I was making a batch of the Queen's favourite German biscuits when suddenly a preposterous idea struck me. I would tell the Queen the truth. If she decided to dismiss me, so be it. But if not, she would be a protector with whom no Scotland Yard inspector could argue. I arranged some of the biscuits on a fancy doily, put them on the tray with a sprig of freesias, and went boldly up the stairs to the Queen's sitting room. I was expecting to encounter the Munshie outside the door, but the hallway was deserted. That probably meant that he was in there with her. Did I have the nerve to knock and enter? I stood with my hand poised for a long moment before I whispered to myself, "What have you got to lose, Bella?" And I tapped. The door was opened, not by the Indian, but by one of the Queen's ladies.
"Yes," she said.
"I've just baked some of Her Majesty's favourite biscuits, and I thought she might need cheering up at this sad time," I said. The lady frowned at me.
"You are a cook?"
"Yes, my lady. Her Majesty knows me. We have spoken together on several occasions. May I bring the biscuits in to her?"
"You must be the one who was falsely accused of putting a poisoned mushroom into a pie."
"Yes, that was me," I said, meeting her gaze with my head held high. She looked a little unsure.
"I'll take the tray then, although I don't think Her Majesty feels like eating at the moment. She has been distressed by the news." "Who is it, Lady Lytton?"
the Queen's voice asked.
"A young woman cook with biscuits," the lady called back. "Your favourites, apparently." "Ah, my sweet young cook. Have her bring them to me," the Queen said.
Lady Lytton stepped aside and permitted me to enter the room. The Queen was sitting in a rocking chair by the open window.
even though the breeze was still quite chilly today. I suspected she might have been dozing as her spectacles and a sheet of paper were in her lap. I crossed the room and went up to her, giving a curtsy before I said, "I made a batch of your Lebkuchen, Mum. I know how fond you are of them, and I thought you might like some while they are still warm." The Queen looked up and smiled.
"How thoughtful. Yes, I believe I might try one."
Then she looked across at her lady-in-waiting.
"Perhaps some tea would go well with these. Would you ask for some to be sent up, Lady Lytton?"
Lady Lytton curtsied and departed. The Queen smiled at me, reached forward and took a biscuit. She ate slowly, savouring as she chewed.
"Just how I remember them from my girlhood," she said. "But you have been through an ordeal yourself, have you not? Sir Arthur apprised me of the whole sorry business, falsely accused of trying to poison me with a mushroom."
I nodded. "Yes, Your Majesty, I told them I would never do anything to harm you, but they didn't want to listen." She sighed.
"Such a sad business. Poor Sophie. To be so desperate that she had to resort to such means. I blame myself, you know. She begged me not to have to marry him. I didn't listen. I was more intent on political gain, on making sure the Empire was on firm footing when I handed over to my wayward son. I can see Wilhelm would not have made an ideal husband. A rather bombastic young man. Vain. Probably would have been a bully."
"Worse than that, Mum," I said. "He made advances to a male member of the household. He told Princess Sophie that he would never bother her again once she produced an heir."
"Gracious," the Queen looked quite startled. "That is news to me. I can see why the poor girl was so desperate to escape. That side of marriage I always found so pleasurable. To be denied it," she sighed and took another biscuit from the plate.
"Your Majesty, there is something else," I said hurriedly, as I sensed I was about to be dismissed. "I came into your service under false pretenses, and I have lived in fear of being discovered ever since."
"What do you mean?"
She was frowning at me now.
"You are going to tell me you are really a Russian spy?"
I had to laugh at this.
"No, Mum,"
and I told her the whole story. She listened patiently.
"It seems to me," she said at last, "that all you did was to make the most of an opportunity. I needed a cook. You supplied one. A rather good one, as it turned out. And nobody is the worse off for it. So what is your real name?"
"Isabella Waverley, Mum."
"Any relation to the Earl of Altrincham?"
"His cousin, Mum. I told you before that my parents died. My father made it clear that he had appealed to the family for help and been rejected, so I had no option but to go into service to support my little sister."
"Admirable. You have a sense of duty like my own. But I'm surprised at the Waverleys rejecting you."
"I didn't appeal to them personally, Mum. I was too young at the time to know anything about my father's family."
"I understand they are also on the Riviera. Shall you visit them now, do you think?"
"Well, Lady Mary Crozier wanted to arrange a tea party for me to meet them, but so far they have shown no interest in such an invitation."
"You should be back amongst your own kind," the Queen said. "It is not right to have you working below stairs when you come from a good family. I gather you were instrumental in working out how the Count was killed. Sir Arthur was quite complimentary of your powers of observation and deduction. It occurs to me that I could always use you as my spy."
She gave me an impish little smile.
"What would you say to that?"
"Your spy, Mum?"
"Yes. You'd be a member of my household and keep your eyes and ears open for anything that I should need to know."
"I'm flattered, but I enjoy cooking, Mum." She looked offended.
"I'm offering you a chance to move into the right circles, you silly girl. You'd be one of my ladies, with a chance to meet men of the right social standing. And you'd be doing me a service, too."
She paused.
"I could order you two, you know."
"I'm aware of that, Mum," I said, "and I have no wish to upset you.
I realize you are being extremely kind to me, and it's a wonderful offer. But, she waved a finger at me, you'd prefer slaving away over a hot stove to becoming one of my ladies. As strange as it may sound to you, yes, I think so. If word got out that I was your spy, I'd be mistrusted and avoided everywhere I went. Also, your ladies spend a lot of their time with nothing constructive to do. I have been working hard for so long now that I'd find it strange to be unemployed. She actually patted my hand. You and I are kindred spirits. I have worked every day of my life since the age of 18 when I became queen. I have read the dispatch boxes dutifully every day, made sure I knew what was going on in my government and in the world so that I could properly advise my ministers. They haven't always thanked me for it, of course, and she smiled again. Very well. I accept your refusal reluctantly. I, too, need someone to be on my side, strange though it may seem. And now that dear Abdul has gone... Your Indian servant, is he indisposed? He is gone, she said in a flat voice. One of the reasons I have been feeling so depressed. I miss him. I was forced to send him away, you know. My gentlemen have been pressuring me for some time, trying to convince me he was unsuitable. I thought it was mere jealousy and prejudice against a lesser race, but it turns out they may have been right. It seems he has been meeting with a man who is engaged in trying to drive the British from India, actively working against us. Abdul claimed this man was just a friend, but he has had access to my papers, to the most confidential secrets of the realm. I saw that I could no longer take the risk, for the sake of the Empire, so I had to send him away. She paused, staring out of the window. The breeze had become stronger, swirling out the net curtains. I went over and shut it hastily. It pains me, she said. He had become a special friend. A queen has few friends. But you have your family, ma'am, your ladies and gentlemen, all of whom are very fond of you. That may be so, but he was different. He didn't stand on protocol. He scolded me when I needed scolding. He teased me, made me laugh, made me feel like a woman, the way my dear John Brown did, and my beloved Albert before him. She looked up at me. I enjoy the company of handsome young men. Is that so foolish at my age? I smiled. Not at all, ma'am. You have lived a life bound by duty. You deserve any happiness you are offered. She examined me for a long moment. You are a sweet child, she said. You shall come and chat with me when you bring up my special biscuits. I shall be honored, ma'am, I said. I should leave you and return to my kitchen. Is there anything special you might want for your dinner tonight? I don't have much of an appetite, she said, which is unusual for me. Some fish, I think, and maybe a fowl. But probably no mushrooms. She saw my worried face. Then she chuckled. Chapter 36 It never rains, but it pours, was one of my father's favourite sayings. In his case, it usually referred to misfortune or misery. In my case, it was quite the opposite. All of a sudden, a burden had been lifted from my shoulders. The Queen wanted me to be her spy. Not a job I would ever have taken. Imagine the suspicion and distrust amongst the other ladies of the household if they thought I was listening to conversations and reporting back to the Queen. And Lady Mary Crozier wanted to take me under her wing. Also, my position as cook was safe at last. I wondered if I should tell my story to the other cooks and change my name. All in good time. I'd have to think of the right way to do it. But it was all rather heady for someone who had felt herself an outcast and unloved for so long. And as my father also said, good things come in threes. That very day, I received an invitation to tea with the Marquise de Crozier. I told Mr. Angelo that I would be gone for the afternoon. Tea with the Marquise? He said, raising an eyebrow. My...
We have moved up in the world while I've been away.
I realised as I went to change that I hadn't asked his permission. I had announced my plans to him, and he had not queried them. Somehow our relationship had changed now that I had handled the entire kitchen. There was a new layer of respect and gratitude. I just hoped it lasted. I thought about this as I made my way down to Lady Mary's villa that afternoon. I had choices now. Did I want to stay in the palace kitchen, where it would be years before I was promoted to anything above an assistant cook? Had I learned enough to make my own way in the world? Or should I really consider one of the offers that had been made to me? Was it finally time to return to my proper status? It was a hard decision, and I realised that Giles Waverley might have something to do with it. Lady Mary greeted me warmly as I was shown into the sitting room. The two men who had been sitting there rose to their feet. Giles Waverley gave me a delighted and surprised smile, and I realised that Lady Mary had not told them I'd be joining them. The older man, who I presumed was the Earl, bore a striking resemblance to my father. The same fine bone structure and strong jaw, the same deep-set eyes, although the Earl was now quite portly and my father had remained painfully thin. I observed the Earl's face. He was staring at me with a puzzled frown. I wondered if he had heard something about me that had displeased him until he said,
"You remind me of someone, young lady. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it will come to me."
"Your cousin Roderick, maybe, my lord," I said.
"That's it, Roddy, when he was young."
He gave me a questioning look.
"And you are?"
"Isabella Waverley, his daughter," I said.
"Good God,
fancy that.
Is this the girl you've been talking about, Giles? Why didn't you tell me that she was a cousin?"
"I didn't know," Giles said, a confused look on his face.
"You said your name was Helen Barton."
"That was the name I had to work under when I became a cook at the palace," I said.
"A cook?"
The Earl looked startled now.
"You became a cook?"
"Out of necessity, my lord. My parents died. My sister and I were left with no money and no place to go. I had to support her, so I went into service."
"Why the devil didn't you come to us?" the Earl blustered. "We didn't even know that Roddy had married and had children. We thought he was still in India."
"The answer to that is that I knew nothing about you. My father told us he had fallen out with his family and could not turn to them for help."
"Stupid boy," the Earl said, glancing at his son. "Your father was not the easiest of men, I'm afraid to say, Isabella. He got into trouble at Oxford. Gambling debts, bad checks, that kind of thing. I gather he ran with a wild crowd, drank too much, lived high on the hog without the means to do so. His own parents were dead. My father was paying for his education. He told Roddy that he'd settle his debts, but he was sending him back to India to make a man of himself. He'd arranged for a commission in an Indian regiment, and then he never wanted to see him again. And we heard no more from him, presumed he was still in India."
"He had to resign his commission and come back to England because my mother couldn't take the climate," I said. "I'm afraid that drink was his downfall in the end."
He nodded.
"Sad business. But you seem to be made of sterner stuff. You have the proper Waverley blood flowing through your veins. Well done, Isabella.
And you must call me Cousin George. Come and sit here beside me, and you shall tell us all about the royal household." He patted the sofa beside him. I caught Lady Mary's eye, and she gave me a nod of encouragement. We chatted, we ate cucumber sandwiches and petit four, and afterward the Earl told Giles to escort me back to the hotel. I couldn't be sure, but I think he gave Giles a wink.
"Why didn't you tell me that we were related?" Giles said as soon as we had left the villa. "I felt like a fool not knowing."
"Because I had to prevent my true identity from being known at that time," I said, and I related the story to him.
"Ye gods," he said, "that's quite a tale. You poor girl, you've been through a lot."
"I'm still here," I replied, "and things are looking up at last."
"So what will you do now?" he asked. "You can't go back to being a cook."
"I'm not sure. Your father has invited me to come and stay at Kingsbury, which is awfully nice of him.
Lady Mary has suggested I stay with her, and the Queen doesn't want me to leave. It's all rather overwhelming after feeling unwanted for so long. I hope you take up our offer, he said. He was looking at me like an expectant dog hoping for a treat. I want to see more of you, Bella. I think my father wants us to be better acquainted too. I thought you were a splendid girl from the moment I laid eyes on you, and now I know how strong you are, I think you'd make a perfect wife for me. I need someone like you to keep me on the straight and narrow. Father has been pressuring me to settle down and marry, you know, and I think he might like to keep it all in the family, so to speak. It's a little early to be talking like that, I said. You don't really know me, Giles. I'm the sort of chap who makes up his mind quickly, Giles said. When I see something I like, I know instantly. And I knew instantly about you, Bella. I think we'd have a grand old life together. I'll inherit Kingsbury someday. The pater is not without cash. You'll finally be where you are supposed to be. He paused, took a deep breath, then said, I may not be the brightest chap in the world, nor the most athletic, but I'm a good sort. Do you think you could be happy married to someone like me? I think I probably could, I said cautiously, but let's take it one step at a time, Giles. Of course, he agreed, nodding. I don't want to rush you. At least say you'll come to stay. He took my hand, holding it between his own. And we can take it from there. Wasn't this what I had wanted, dreamed of? Of course it was. Mistress of a grand house, all the leisure in the world, money for clothes, money to travel, and yet I hesitated. Carpe diem, Bella, said my father's voice. Of course I'll come to stay, I said, but I can't leave the other cooks in the lurch here. You'll have to wait until we return to London. I can wait as long as it takes, if I have you to look forward to, he said, squeezing my hand now. I changed out of my good dress and stumbled back to the kitchen in a daze. I started making a pudding for dinner, mechanically stirring in ingredients. Was this what I wanted to do all my life? Cook for other people? Be a servant when I could have people to wait on me?
Attention! Pay attention!
A warning voice said sharply behind me.
You are burning the butter.
I jumped, pulled the pan off the flame and turned to see Jean-Paul standing behind me.
I was watching you, he said. You have your head in the clouds today. It's not like you to burn the butter.
He was looking at me with concern.
What is wrong? Are you still worried?
I understand that you are not being held responsible for the death of that nobleman. They are saying now that he took his own life. Drugs, so I hear. Is that what they are saying? I asked. I'm sorry. I'm a little confused today. I think I just received a proposal of marriage.
You think?
It wasn't a formal proposal, but a proposal nonetheless.
And did you accept?
I might have indicated my willingness to accept, I admitted.
Who is this man?
His voice was sharp now. An English milord, I said. I shall become a viscountess and live in a fine house.
And what of your passion? He demanded. It has disappeared. You will no longer cook. You will have someone to do that for you. You will accept mediocre food, knowing that you could have cooked it better. You will sit and do embroidery or gossip to while away the time until your next meal. Is that what you really want?
You are shouting, I said. I realized the kitchen had become very still and the others were watching us.
Come outside.
He took my arm and forced me from the kitchen.
Let go of me. You're hurting me, I said.
We cannot discuss this in front of the others.
He propelled me along the hallway. We came into the open air at the back of the hotel. Seagulls were whirling in the breeze, crying above us.
Jean-Paul turned me to face him. Tell me this is what you want, what you really want.
I shall miss cooking, I said slowly, but I have to think of my future. I had to work like a slave from the time I was a young girl because I had nobody to take care of my sister and me. Who would turn down the chance for a life of luxury and security?
Do you love this man? He asked.
I hardly know him. He seems pleasant enough. Even as I said the words, I heard Giles's voice saying that he needed a strong woman to keep him on the straight and narrow. Did he have problems with drink and gambling, as my father had done? Was this something that ran in the family? I realized how very little I knew about Giles. Pleasant enough.
Is that what you want in a husband? His voice had risen again. A milquetoast little Englishman who minces around with lace on his cuffs and doesn't know what to do with a woman.
How do you know what he is like? I was shouting back at him now.
Because I see the English milords. They are spoiled little boys, not real men. Will he ever kiss you like this?
He grabbed me and brought his mouth against mine with such force that I couldn't breathe. I tried to push him away, but I realized I wasn't trying very hard. When we broke apart, he stood looking down at me with those dark eyes burning with passion.
Will he make you feel alive?
When I didn't answer, he said softly,
"Don't make a mistake you will regret for the rest of your life."
What if it's my one chance at happiness? What if I turn him down, and then one day I become sick or injured with nowhere to go and nobody to look after me?
Why should it be your one chance?
I am an undercook. I sleep in a narrow little bed, and I do what I am told. Maybe I want more.
You could always stay here, Jean-Paul said at last.
What do you mean? I looked up, seeing those dark eyes looking at me with intensity.
When the Queen and the Milords go home. You like it here?
You're right. I do like it, but I can hardly stay here and work at the hotel. You have no female chefs.
I was thinking the time might be right for me to open my own restaurant, he said. You could come and work with me.
I gave a nervous little laugh. I don't think that would be proper. Where would I live?
We could get married, of course, he said.
You and I?
You and I, he said. Why not? You like me. I know you do. I did not see how I could ever marry, because it would not be fair to a wife to have a husband who is never at home in the evenings. But if I had a wife who worked beside me, who shared my passion, think what we could do together.
You're only saying this because another man has asked me to marry him, I said uncertainly. You don't want me to marry an Englishman. You don't really mean it.
Cherie, I have wanted you from the first moment I set eyes on you, he said. But I told myself that you were not attracted to me the way I was to you. So I said nothing.
You'd really want to leave this position at the hotel? I asked, still trying to come to grips with his proposal and my own building excitement. Isn't this a plum job?
Of course, he said. But more and more foreigners are coming to Nice now. There are good restaurants, but no outstanding restaurants. No cordon bleu. No reason for fashionable people to come down from Paris or Berlin. The time is right.
I think it could be a magnificent success. Starting a restaurant would take money, I said, still not wanting to trust my instinct.
I am not without money, he replied with a proud toss of his head. My father has done well. I have done well. You would not starve, ma petite, I promise you.
You only want me to come and cook with you, I said.
Why are you saying these things? He demanded. If you do not wish to marry me, say so now and put me out of my misery, but please accept the truth. I want you, he said simply. I think we could have an incredible life together. I guarantee you would never be bored. So what do you say?
What could I say? I, who had despised my sister for marrying into trade, who had the chance to become Viscountess Faversham, heard myself saying the words,
I think I would like that very much.
You are leaving my service to marry? The Queen asked me.
It was April, and her time in Nice was drawing to a close.
Is it the young Waverley boy?
No, ma'am. I'm afraid I'm going to marry a Frenchman and stay here.
Gracious me! And where did you meet this Frenchman?
He is the head chef at the hotel, ma'am. We are going to open a restaurant together.
You are full of surprises, Miss Waverley. I hope you know what you are doing, settling down so far from home.
Lady Mary married a Frenchman and seems very happy, I said.
Yes, but he is a nobleman. You will be working hard for your living.
I told you once that I want to be occupied, and cooking beside my husband seems perfect to me.
Then I wish you well, she said. Having a good man at your side is the best any woman can hope for. May you be as happy with him as I was with my dear Albert.
And shortly after that, I had another encounter. I was walking along the Promenade d'Anglais, admiring the incredible blue of the water, dotted with the white sails of yachts and the red sails of fishing boats. The light sparkled and danced. It was almost too heady to be real. And suddenly, I found myself thinking about Helen Barton. If she had been alive and taken her rightful place in the kitchen, maybe she might have been standing here at this moment, not me. And a great wave of pity came over me that her life had been snuffed out so young, and she never had a chance for love or happiness. I wanted to do something for her, something in her memory. But I knew she had no family apart from her brother. I turned away from the ocean, and coming towards me was Ronnie Barton himself. His face took on that sarcastic smirk I had so loathed. It was a face I had wanted to smack so many times.
"Well, if it isn't my long-lost sister," he said. "We heard there was a spot of scandal that involved you. Some bloke died, something to do with poisoned mushrooms."
I gave him a hard stare. "I'm afraid you have it wrong. It turned out to be nothing with mushrooms at all."
"Lucky for you, eh?" he said.
"I bet they'd be interested to know you were involved in another death before this. Do the French still have the guillotine?" "Why don't you give up these silly threats?" I said. "There is nothing you can do to me."
"Really?"
he said.
"Actually, I'm glad you were not found guilty of poisoning."
He paused, then added,
"You'd be no use to me in a French prison or with your head chopped off."
"I will be no use to you whatever from now on," I said. "Now, if you'll excuse me." I tried to walk past him. He blocked my path.
"I hear the Queen's going home next week. I may be coming to visit you in London. I can think of a couple of little favours I may want from you."
"The Queen may be going home, but I'm not," I said.
"Ah, so they found out about you, did they?" He was grinning now. "Kicked you out at last, poor dear. So what are you going to do with yourself?"
"I'm actually taking another name," I said. "I have grown tired of being Helen Barton."
"What did you do? Push another girl under an omnibus?"
I was about to answer when I heard my name being called. I turned to see Jean-Paul running towards me.
"A thousand pardons for keeping you waiting, Sherry,"
he said, and kissed my cheek.
"But I have exciting news. A building that I think will be perfect for us."
He stopped, noticing Ronnie standing in front of me.
"And who is this?" Jean-Paul asked me, still in French.
"An Englishman who has been annoying me for a long time," I said. I looked Ronnie directly in the eye. "I am about to be married, Mr. Barton. This is my fiancé. He is a famous chef, and his family is very influential in Nice. His grandfather was mayor once."
Jean-Paul was sizing up the skinnier, slighter man. He stepped forward. "And I do not like anyone who upsets my bride," he said in surprisingly good English. "She is right. I am a famous chef, and I am extremely talented with a knife. If I can bone a duck in 2 minutes, just think what I can do to you. Do not let me see you again."
He took my arm.
"Come, Cherie, we have a restaurant to buy."
"Good luck to you marrying a frog,"
Ronnie called as we moved past him.
"You'll be begging to come home to England in no time at all."
I couldn't resist turning back to him.
You don't know me, Mr. Barton. You've never known me. I can think of nothing more splendid than living here with a man who loves me, and one day I expect the prince will find out the truth about you, and you'll get what you deserve. But I won't be the one to tell him. Good day to you. Then we walked away without looking back. On the 3rd of June, I married Jean-Paul Le Pan in the Church of Notre Dame of the Immaculate Conception behind the Old Port. Lady Mary outfitted me for the occasion. The Queen gave me a set of pearls. My fellow cooks were more practical and sent a set of jelly molds in case they were not obtainable in France. My sister and her husband came over for the wedding. She really was expecting a child this time and looked positively radiant. "Billy has put off the idea of going to Australia until the little one is born," she said. "Maybe he'll have a cousin someday soon." And that wistful look came into her eyes again as she realized that the cousins would be thousands of miles apart. After we returned from our honeymoon on the Italian Riviera, we opened a restaurant that I insisted on calling La Belle Hélène, just off the Promenade d'Anglaise. It was my small tribute to Helen Barton. It has large arched windows that look across gardens to the bay, and we designed it with intimate booths around the walls. We have made local seafood dishes our specialty, and I have learned to create a really good baba o'rum. As Jean-Paul predicted, it has been a magnificent success. People come from all over the Riviera to dine with us, including the Prince of Wales with his latest conquest. I wisely stayed in the kitchen just in case. And I am able to pursue my passion for cooking, but I have recently found a new love in my life. He is called Louis, after Jean-Paul's father and my sister, and he lies contentedly in his cradle while his parents create tambal, terrine and soufflé. Sometimes I let him suck on my finger when I have created a particularly delicious batter or sauce. He is clearly going to inherit his parents' palate.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Above the Bay of Angels, a novel. Written by Reese Bowen, performed by Gemma Dawson. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer Chelsea Pita. Copyright 2020 by Janet Quinn Harkin, writing as Reese Bowen. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.